A Relationship of Trust was a talk given by Chris Swanson at the 2025 Gutenberg Education Conference titled Teacher as Mentor. Dr. Chris Swanson is president and tutor here at Gutenberg College. He specializes in teaching science and math in addition to his duties leading discussions for Western civilization and great conversation. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Thank you, David. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to test our technology and hopefully I'm going to be able to move my slides forward. Yes, too far. Well, thank you all for coming. I am going to start with a little story. I am a math and science guy. My background was always in math and science, and I have all the stereotypical behaviors of the math science person. I realized in seventh grade that my friends and I were going to eat lunch in a particular Spanish teacher's classroom because we wanted to avoid the highly dangerous social milieu of the lunchroom. We found ancient games that were like chess, and we played those. Yes, I was that guy. So I am going to talk about relationships and mentorship. Right. Fortunately for you, I'm going to lean into my nerdiness, and I am going to be analyzing relationships and mentoring and how they impact students, and I'm sure that there will be others more qualified than me that actually talk about the important things of relationships. Okay, so my thesis is that everything students learn is anchored in relationships with ideas and people, and to mentor well, we should understand how relationships impact learning and cherish those relationships. If this doesn't make complete sense right now, don't worry. I'm going to bring this slide back up at the end, and hopefully it will make more sense at the end. I've divided the subject into five areas. I realize that you're supposed to put it into three, but five is also a good prime number, so I'm a math guy. We're going to five. So facts, left, right, relationships, mentorship, and trust in God. Okay, let's start with facts. Okay, why am I talking about facts when we're talking about mentorship and relationships? It turns out that we often think about facts in terms of things which are impersonal, objective, unbiased facts. And I think that that is a myth. That in fact, facts are actually beliefs that we have that are personal. They have very complex associations, and they are embedded in us. So, in the two different ways that we can think about knowing things, there is the one kind, which is the external kind of unbiased way of knowing, and there is the personal, relational kind of knowing. Okay, so on the unbiased, impersonal way of knowing, let's dig into that a little bit by thinking about sort of the standard view of knowledge. Now, at Gutenberg, we spend 4 years talking about this particular slide. You guys are going to get 4 minutes or less. So the standard view, of course, starts with the Greeks, because what doesn't start with the Greeks? And the idea is that there are fundamental first principles. And from those first principles, which are obvious and everybody accepts, one can demonstrate new things and new knowledge. Okay? The paradigm for this would be Euclidean geometry, all of the things in the quadrivium, for instance, would have been associated with this kind of demonstrable knowledge, okay? Skipping ahead a few hundred years here, this particular mode of thinking becomes a really important part of the way the West thinks about knowledge. Oh, by the way, the other way of knowing is opinion. You guys are going to run into this when we read the Meno. Okay. So we start asking questions in the Enlightenment about what about those first principles? Where do they come from? And there are differing answers, obviously. One of them from Descartes is that the first principles come from the pure light of reason. Our minds are able to understand and know directly in some way of what those first principles are. Other people said that first principles come primarily through empirical sense, sense perceptions and things of that sort. So those are two different ways that the mind is somehow a wax tablet, and the sense experiences come and make an impression upon our brains or the wax tablet, the ideas inside. Now, this particular project of knowing things demonstrably, scientifically, certainty, ran into a number of criticisms that develop throughout the rest of Western civilization. I've just thrown up a few of those. One criticism, of course, is that our knowledge is purely subjective. You know, if the pure light of reason or the sense experiences is coming into us, we are the masters in some sense of the knowledge. It is all inside of us. We can't necessarily know what's going on outside of there. Another criticism that came up was that knowledge is actually constructed inside of a community, inside of a culture, a language, a structure that we're born into. And those languages and structures and communities are fallible, and there are different communities and different structures, and so who's to say which community actually has it right? A third one, sort of the more modern American style, is pragmatism, which says that the things which we are going to accept as quote-unquote true are those which work, things that make it possible for us to accomplish engineering feats and work along in our daily life. The problem with all of these systems, all of these criticisms, what they ultimately find is this whole project of finding absolutely certain truth through demonstrative processes from first principles doesn't quite work, right? And in the end, truth is in fact lost. And that is the world that we live in today, where there is no truth. A different, totally separate way of thinking about facts is that facts are in fact personal. We know things, we have concepts that are in us, that are formed from really complex associations that we make in our everyday lives, from our experiences. So if we take a concept like literature, it is that word or that concept is associated with lots of different other things. It means multiple things in multiple contexts. It may mean fiction or crime or poetry, all these sorts of things. We may have emotional connections with the word literature. Maybe it is something that we're very excited about. Maybe it's something that is boring or fearful. All these connections and relationships are all associated with this idea of literature. In the process of creating this multifaceted structure of ideas around these concepts, we slowly but surely, as we grow, we build a framework of concepts, a framework of ideas and beliefs that make sense of the experience that we are having. Those frameworks are sort of unspecifiable, hard to talk about or explain. They are sort of embedded in you. They are very, very personal. In the process of creating these frameworks, we are taking parts that we experience, specific, particular parts, and we are forming them into wholes. Every time we talk, we take parts of words and structures, and we create a meaningful whole. Every time we are thinking about things, we are putting together ideas and experiences, things that we're seeing, and we're putting them together in a meaningful whole. The parts in and of themselves don't necessarily have meaning by themselves in the same way that the little Lego brick doesn't have any particular meaning on and in and of itself. But when you put all the Lego bricks together in a particular way and structure it in just this way, then you have a meaningful whole. You've got the wave with the surfer in the Lego bricks. In order to make sense of anything, in order to understand anything, we have to assume, in some sense, the truth. We have to believe in the parts. We cannot be asking questions and doubting the parts. The parts are subsidiary. They are making together the whole, the meaningful whole. And if we don't believe and accept those parts, then we can't make sense of the whole. So the subsidiary parts are assumed. They necessarily are part of what we know to be true. And if we didn't know those things, then we couldn't make sense of the world at all. That framework, the putting together of parts into a whole, is also important for just living life and making predictions in novel situations that may come up. What is going to happen next? How is it going to work? That sort of thing. And the fact that we have that framework, the fact that we have all of that information that is embedded in us, makes it possible for us to make predictions. A classic example, the one that we often talk about at Gutenberg College, is the example of the Copernican system. In the 1500s, Copernicus comes along and he says that the parts of the solar system, while nicely put together in the Earth-centered system, don't work together as a whole. It was the artistic and the elegant and beautiful construction of a whole with the sun in the center that was compelling to him to put together a solar system that made sense with the sun in the center. In this process, and thinking about facts as being personal, as being embedded in us, as being part of the assumptions that we use in our everyday life, truth is regained. We know things. They are truth. They are true. But we make mistakes. It is only in the context of the other mode of knowing that we have to reject that as truth, just because we make mistakes. The other side only wants things which are undoubtable and unassailable to be truth. But that, in fact, is not the way we as human beings operate. Truth is those things that we know on an everyday basis and that we can make sense of, even if there is a possibility of us making mistakes. Okay. I'm going to move to left-right. So what do I mean by left-right? I'm going to talk about the left and the right side of the brain. This is coming from a really interesting book that I have read recently by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary. The two hemispheres of the brain have two complementary functions. But our modern world overly relies on the left side and does so at our own peril. The master should be the right, not the left. This is Ian McGilchrist's conclusion as he does all of his research on brain science and how things are put together and how that interacts with our culture. And I thought it was a really interesting thesis that he proposes. So I'm going to give us a better sense of the difference between the left and the right, and I'm going to do so by making all of these associations by reading these words. Words associated with the left side of the brain and words associated with the right, and hopefully we can get some sense of what's going on here. The left side of the brain is going to be interested in or focused on rules and procedures, control, utility, structure, abstraction. It is disembodied, universal, unchanging, decontextualized, detached, machine-like, precise, logical, demythologized, language-oriented, category-oriented, analytical, dividing into parts, linear thinking, a representation of the world. What the left is good at, and this is a good thing, is taking the information that we have and creating categories and structures to represent the world to our mind. The right, on the other hand, is doing something altogether different. It is interacting in terms of the personal, relational, contextual, evolving but not fully understood, holistic, synthesizing, a responsibility of care, empathetic, wondering, musical, identification and recognition of people and faces, experiential, metaphorical, story-based, nonlinear thinking, a source of meaning, humor, and deals with most of the emotions. Okay, that is what the right side is particularly well suited for. This is coming from all of this brain research that McGilchrist has put together. And it's fairly extensive and it's a good argument. He says that the two sides work together. The left creates a structure for the experience that we have from the right. The right then uses the categories of the left to synthesize the experience into a holistic, meaningful connection of relationships. There's actually stories of people who have had lesions or strokes or damage on the right side of the brain, and they are people who have much difficulty with personal empathy, things like that. They exhibit the exact kind of symptoms that people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia have. Okay, so let's look at some examples of how the left and the right work on sort of an everyday basis. Let's talk about a few things. I'm talking a few subjects. We'll try history and then math and physics. I wonder why I chose those. But anyway, I did. So in history, the left is going to create a representation of the world, a framework. It's going to be political, moral, philosophical, economic. It's a theory with periods. You might have the Bronze Age and antiquity and Reformation and Enlightenment. These are really good categories that we create to represent the historical world to ourselves. The right is going to engage with stories, personal experiences, interconnected and constantly in flux. If you want to think about somebody who represents history from the right side through stories of personal interactions, you might think of somebody like Plutarch, if you've ever read any of his stories. So, for instance, suppose we were wanting to talk about Benjamin Franklin, right? We can categorize Ben Franklin as somebody who was a founding father, a printer, a scientist. He was a member of the Continental Congress, an ambassador to France. We have all of the categories. Maybe we understand who Ben Franklin is because we have put him in all of these various categories. We have a structure for understanding Benjamin Franklin, or we could maybe read a biography of Benjamin Franklin. And if we read the biography, what we see is that he is a complex, passionate person juggling conflicting desires and challenges just like the rest of us do. There are going to be multiple associations that we have with Benjamin Franklin in reading a biography, taking in personal, experiential kinds of things creating a framework for Benjamin Franklin that is much more nuanced and interesting than simply putting him in categories. The same thing could be said about the way the left and the right works with mathematics. Now, we normally think of mathematics probably as being very left-oriented, and it can be. Things like systems and techniques, disembodied, detached, that abstractness of, say, the algebra class that often students are going to struggle with because there is no contextual grounding for those abstract categories into their physical world. If you were doing mathematics more on the right, it would be more embodied. So like a young child, right? They learn the word three, right? The word, they might say fui, right? How old are you? Everybody's always asking your age. I'm three. So they have this physical representation of three. It's the number of candles on their cake. It's something that comes up over and over again. It's the number that comes after two when he counts, and it is probably the symbol on the Sesame Street program that is walking across the screen. These are very experiential relational associations of the word three that connects together in a way that is very intuitive. It is not abstract. When you do large numbers, right, you have to move into abstractions. It is very hard to have an intuition of 1,235,365, right? That's very hard to do. Well, think about physics. Physics also has a left and right side of things. I took a lot of physics classes, obviously, and my experience was I learned lots of formulas, and I learned lots of equations, and I learned lots of techniques for solving problems. It was all very mathematical. It was all very much structured. I learned all these concepts and stuff like that. But I really had a hard time connecting the stuff that I learned in the physics class with the physical, real world. It wasn't until I was starting to teach that I started making some of these connections. So like, if you want to learn about motion, you might go on a merry-go-round, right? Go sit on a merry-go-round and swirl around and feel the forces and throw a ball up and see if it comes back down in your hand or something like that. Watch inertia and see how all those ideas connect together in a very physical, real way. That would be the right side, experiencing the world, putting those structures and ideas into the context of the concepts that you learn in physics. Okay, so hopefully you get some idea of the distinction that I'm making here between the left and the right, and you will also hopefully see there is a distinction here between the way people think about knowledge and facts, right? I'm claiming that knowledge is very personal, it's very embedded. The standard view of epistemology of knowledge is that knowledge is very external and abstract. It's a very left way of thinking about knowledge. Okay. Relationships. Okay. Knowledge of a person, as opposed to facts, is a tacit, unarticulated interconnection of right brain experiences. Okay? We are still creating a framework, but the framework is, in this case, mostly on the right. You are able to have a relationship with a person without having abstract categories for them, right? Especially children are doing that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about relationships. Getting to know you. How are relationships formed? Relationships are usually relational, holistic, connected experiences that we get from the right side, are processed through the right side. If we wanted to think about a person from the left, we might be doing some sort of stereotyping or something. This is this kind of person, putting them in a particular kind of category. But we do not need to categorize a person to have a relationship, okay? The way that we learn about somebody is through a skillful construction of this tacit, inarticulate framework. It is a difficult but important process of learning about people by experiencing them and making sense of who they are and what they're going to do. Children do it very well. They all know, for instance, in the family or among their friends or whatever, which of these adults is likely to play with me and which one is not, whether they have the words to say it. They know these sorts of things. Why? They have experienced it through attempts to get other people to play, right? Adults also are creating these complex associations, this framework, this relational framework with people, but it's far, far more nuanced. It's based on so much more context, so much more experience. I've experienced other people. I've experienced all sorts of things. My experiences with this person are maybe loving or maybe they are hurtful. And we are also experiencing relationships vicariously, for instance, in stories. We are reading lots and lots of stories about how this particular relationship went well or poorly or something along that. We learn about the nature of people and how they interact with us, and we learn about particular people. And that is how we are skillfully, it takes a lot of effort to do it, but we are putting these things together into a framework where we could say that we know a person. Hopefully you see a connection between knowing a person and my description of what it means to know a fact. There is a lot of interrelated connections and associations for knowing a person in the same way. There is a lot of interrelated connections about knowing what we refer to as facts. This knowledge of a person also allows us to make predictions. We can make simple behavioral predictions, like for instance, if I throw a ball to such and such a child, we can predict based on our knowledge of the child whether they're likely to catch the ball. I mean, we may not be right every time, but we have a pretty good idea of their skill level and whether they're going to catch the ball. Can we articulate our knowledge of their ability? Do we have a framework for that? Maybe, maybe not. We don't really need it because we just know, right? We might know also how somebody is going to react if you give them bad news. You probably know very well how your spouse is going to react if you give them bad news, or a friend or something like that. Why? You just know because of your experiences, the framework that you have created over the years or over some particular period of time. Prediction also allows us to trust people. Is this person honest? Do their words correspond to their actions? Are they dependable? Are they going to do what they have always said, right? How do we know that? How do we trust these people? It is through our experiences that we have with them. Okay. We're finally now ready to talk about what we're supposed to talk about here, mentorship. This has all been preamble, right? I'm going to claim that all knowledge is personal and has a core component of trust and commitment. It's that core component of trust and commitment that raises its head in when we think about mentorship. So let's talk about the source of knowledge and how we've been talking about how we get experiential knowledge. It all comes in, we experience it, we make sense of it. How does that work? Well, part of it is we are looking at the source of the information, and we are asking ourselves, does this information that is coming to me, this thing that is coming towards me that I am experiencing maybe from a speech or a book or an experience in life or something like that, does it fit into the framework that I have already created? Does it work with that framework? If it works with the framework, I am very willing to say, oh, yeah. That's right. If the information that comes in does not fit with our framework, we're going to raise red flags. So, is that really true? No, I don't know if that's right. I'm going to check it out. This is sort of the confirmation bias. Things which we believe to be true already easily fit into our framework. Things that we do not believe are not easily fit into our framework, or we have questions about them, or we may resist them. The same thing happens with if the source is a person. Do we trust this person or do we not trust it? you probably are very ready to trust the words of your pastor who is speaking every day. This person is somebody who is trustworthy. They're talking about the Bible, which I trust, things that I know, and they are telling me things. I am very willing to accept that information. However, if somebody named Lennon were up to give a speech and you were listening to this on a screen or something like that, the chances that you would immediately trust and absorb all of his information is less, right? Because you do not trust that source. And so there were people in time that did trust Lennon a lot. His situation in life in Russia at the time that he was living, he was a very trustworthy fellow, the kinds of things that he said, and he had a lot of followers. Another example that I really like for thinking about mentorship in terms of trust is a book called Persuasion by Jane Austen. Hopefully some of you have read it. We have a picture here of young Anne Elliot, and she has been given a proposal of marriage by Wentworth, and she is very attracted to this man, and she wants to accept it. Her mother's friend, her mother has passed away, and her mother's friend has sort of taken her under a wing and is counseling young Anne, and she says, well, this is not the right marriage for you. This is not the right match. It's not going to give you the financial basis maybe that you need, et cetera, et cetera. And Anne, against her better judgment, trusts this woman, this Lady Russell, and says, okay, I'm not going to accept Captain Wentworth's proposal of marriage. It is, however, a Jane Austen book, so spoiler alert, you might want to close your ears. It works out in the end. And that is because Anne starts making her own decisions, and she starts looking at things for herself. Mentorship is going to be related heavily with the connection between trust and evidence, okay? So for instance, younger students, you guys all know when the kids are young, everything you say, they accept. They don't question it, right? The teacher says it, mom and dad say it, they're like, okay, whatever you say, yeah, I believe that, I'm moving on, I'll do that. Sometimes they might not obey you, but at least things that you say, they are very likely to absorb. The things that they get in their textbooks or their books that they're reading, they understand, they go, yes, I get it. But as they get a little bit older, they start asking questions of themselves. Am I going to just immediately trust this source, or am I going to look at some other evidence? If any of you have ever had or seen a rebellious teen, you might see how that works, right? They are making their own decisions, looking at evidence for themselves, and questioning the sources that they are having. I think the relationship of trust, and this is an important piece for mentorship, frees the student to learn, believe, and explore, right? If there is no trust, then they are going to be resistant. I think of somebody trying to provide wisdom and advice and knowledge, and it's like a large wave coming at the young student or the person that you're trying to convince. And if there is a relationship of trust, the wave passes into the student like in the upper picture there and is absorbed by them. If, however, the trust is broken down, then the wave crashes against a cliff and is rejected in some sense. Commitment is another part of this role here. Commitment is a kind of trust in one's own beliefs, right? Beliefs are commitments to what we see as true, and it is expressed in the actions that we take. We may or may not be sure, but as soon as we are called to act, then we are going to expose or produce for ourselves what we actually believe. I think that agnostic aloofness can be debilitating. It is saying that all the things, all the parts that is going to make a whole are questionable. If everything is questionable, what can you do? You can't do anything. You can't move forward, right? Everything is all of a sudden thrown up. Do I believe this? Do I believe that? It's that agnosticism that is debilitating. The agnosticism, I think, of modern scholarship says We cannot really understand an author or a book. It stands above the author criticizing the motives and assumptions. The freedom of scholarship today is the freedom to study any writing we please on the mere condition that we do not believe it to be true, right? It makes it impossible to actually know anything. So hopefully you've got a picture that I'm painting here of mentorship. It is a relationship. It is connected. It is personal. It is all those sorts of things like that. But I want to say one more piece in case you are not convinced about the way I think that the Bible describes and talks about knowing and learning and mentorship. So I'm going to claim that belief in God is rooted in relationship, not a doctrinal structure, that God mentors us in our faith, okay? That the essence of our knowing, our experiencing, our relationship with God is very personal. I want to be clear that I'm not saying that there is no place for doctrinal structure. I am just saying that the essence of Christianity, the essence of our faith is relational. If we look at the history of Christianity, there are a number of pieces because it is in the Western style. And as I mentioned earlier, the Western style is very much moving on the left side of the brain, a structure of putting things into place. That a lot of our ideas about theology are also creating structures and theological structures and doctrinal structures that are influenced by a bunch of different places, like we have influence from the Greeks who are interested. Again, the Greeks are people like Plato and Aristotle are very concerned about categorization and making sense of things that way. So things like substance, what is the substance of God, or what are the attributes of God? Is he omnipresent, omniscient, all those sorts of things? Those are Greek influences that have really influenced the way that we think about what Christianity is all about. The Pharisees is another example of trying to turn Christianity into a structure in terms of law. It is fixed, rule-based, impersonal structure. Salvation for the Pharisees was sort of mechanical. It was detached from themselves. You can see sort of that left impersonal way of thinking about God. And then obviously the religious wars that happened after the Reformation is another great example where people had come to the belief, not all of them, that to some extent salvation was believing the right things. And people who weren't believing the right things were condemned. And so any amount of violence or war was justified because we are talking about one's eternal soul rather than one's earthly existence. This is all a left way of thinking. It is trying to control our anxiety over our status before God, any uncertainty that we may have. It is creating a structure that we can make sense of God that doesn't involve us in a very deeply personal way. I think that the Bible, the entire Bible, creates, shows us that God is trustworthy. He is creating a framework. He shows himself to be trustworthy, merciful, powerful. These are the biblical categories. He spends centuries creating this framework of trust and keeping his promises. And how does he do it? He does it with very personal stories, with individuals and groups of individuals, right? Stories is a way that the right side experiences the world and interacts with the world. His persistent call is to trust and believe and keep his commandments. So for instance, I'm just picking a few examples. They're everywhere throughout the Bible, the story of Noah, I am no longer going to destroy mankind, and you can now know that I am going to be trustworthy with regard to that by giving you this symbol, this rainbow. The Exodus was a story which is very powerful explanation of God being trustworthy. You are suffering in Egypt in slavery, and God is going to bring you out of your difficulties. He is trustworthy. He is powerful. He is going to make this happen through all these plagues, all the way up to the point where the Egyptians are crossing the Red Sea and the waters come down and cover them over, and the Hebrews are safe. This is a wonderful story and example that people can look at very personally, experientially. God is trustworthy. Or in the Judges, over and over again, the Israelites went to idolatry, and God over and over raised up a judge that would deliver them from their enemies, even though they had been idolatrous. Even to the point of, I will save you from your enemies with only 300 men, for instance, in the story of Gideon. Or the return from the Babylonian exile. Again, God is trustworthy. He cares. He loves his people, and he is going to fulfill his promises, even when you guys have absolutely no control and no power. You are enslaved in Babylonia. There is nothing you can do. You have no kings to bring up an army, and still God is trustworthy, and he is going to bring you out of exile and put you back into the promised land, which he promised. Or an example of the Psalms. The Psalms is another great example. They are very personal. They're musical. Again, that's the right-hand side of the brain. They are interacting with God in a way that is saying, I trust you. You are a wonderful God. You're majestic. Look at the things that you have done. Even though I am suffering right now, you are worthy of my trust. Again, very personal interactions between God and, say, David or other psalmists. And the same thing is true, of course, with Jesus. Right? Jesus says, believe in me. He calls everyone to have a relationship with him, to trust him and follow him, to believe in him, and you will have eternal life, is the refrain that comes up over and over again. He says to the Pharisees, if God were your father, you would love me. Not you would follow certain aspects of the law better. You would love me. I am a person here. I am standing right in front of you. He says to his disciples, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. You do not see in the Gospel of John that systematic theology is the way and the truth and the life, right? That is not the case. He does not give a set of objective, impersonal criteria, and if you meet these criteria, then you are good, right? The Pharisees didn't understand it. They were testing him about stoning the woman, if you remember the story, and Jesus' response is not to go into the details of the law and the structure and the impersonal structure. It was to turn things around and confront them personally with their own sin. You know, are you without sin to throw the first stone? So my claim is that God mentored his people as he mentors us. I think the most wonderful example of God mentoring his people is in the story of Abraham. It took many, many, many years of God interacting with Abraham over and over. He said, I am going to give you children. And Abraham was hedging his bets. Well, maybe we haven't had that yet. Maybe my servant here will be a good heir, or maybe I'll have Hagar have a child for me or something. Or he says, I'm going to give you the land. And immediately after he says, I'm going to give you the land, Abraham goes down to Egypt because there's famine in the land. It's just a constant situation where Abraham is trusting but not quite trusting, but God brings him through over his entire life until we get to the most important story, the crucial story where Abraham is willing to trust God so much that he is willing to sacrifice his own son, the son of promise that he had been given. That is a mentorship. And I think that God mentors us. He mentors everybody. He mentors our children. He mentors each of us by taking us through our experiences, using his word, using our relationships with each other, our experiences, our suffering. All of these sorts of things are things that help us to slowly but surely turn our lives around, to focus on him and to understand him. These are personal ways of interacting with us in our life. It is very much a relational approach, in my opinion. It is a mentorship, if you will. So, in conclusion, hopefully this thesis will make more sense now. Everything students learn is anchored in relationship with ideas and people. Mentoring requires that we understand how relationships affect learning and to cherish those relationships. I know that I, being a science guy, am often thinking in terms of abstractions and ideas and things like that. And so I have to remind myself that the things that are ultimately important, the knowledge that really matters, the way that I should really live my life is to focus in on my relationships and my duty of care with people and with my ideas and with God. Thank you very much.
That was A Relationship of Trust by Chris Swanson. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.